From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Canada's government gives the Maroon family a big boost in their drive to build a new Ambassador Bridge. What about the proposed public bridge just a couple miles downstream?
If you're building a brand new six-lane crossing, you know, that the Maroon family is going to operate and get going, what exactly is the need now for the Gordie Howe Bridge?
Congress unites around driverless cars.
This is really revolutionary in a lot of ways, and it's even more revolutionary in the sense that it's A, bipartisan, and B, it's the government trying to get out front of this drive for self-driving cars.
They change the way we eat breakfast. Battle Creek's battling brothers, John Harvey Kellogg and younger brother Will Keith.
He was one of these great Americans that shaped the American century, and yet he was the saddest man.
Those stories and more, but first, the news. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The family that owns the Ambassador Bridge got a boost to their plans to build a new one, replacing their existing 87-year-old bridge. The Maroon family says the Canadian government granted approval for them to build a new cable-stayed six-lane bridge. Dave Battagello is a reporter with the Windsor Star. He's been following bridge developments for many years. Dave, were you surprised by this news?
Yes and no. I'm surprised more at the timing. It's pretty well known that the Ambassador Bridge is aging. It's not in great shape, so at some point it was going to get approvals put in place to get a second or twin span constructed. It's just the timing. All the focus has been on the planned Gordie Howe International Bridge. Everybody was under the understanding that the shovel was going to get in the ground for that one first. And then at some point, the Maroon family will get approvals for their new crossing, but that's not the way things occurred.
What conditions did Ottawa attach to this approval?
They have several conditions, and I think that's the big question mark today is how the Maroons will live up to some of these conditions. The primary one that everybody's kind of focusing on today is the current Ambassador Bridge will have to come down within 5 years after opening up the new span. So everybody's curious how that will play out, whether there's any enforcements attached to it that the Maroon family will indeed follow through on that.
And then what do they have to do some road and infrastructure work on the Windsor side?
Well, the infrastructure, they have a number of properties that they've tied up for years in terms of residential homes, some commercial businesses, some apartment buildings, and they're all boarded up. What Ottawa has said that they have to do is take these buildings down now, and the property that's not immediately needed for the bridge and the plaza has to be turned into parkland. So again, Windsor is concerned whether that's exactly what's going to happen or the Maroons will just leave some derelict property sitting around their plaza and bridge.
Yeah, let's talk a little more about the relationship between the Maroons and the people of Windsor and the Windsor officials. It's been rocky, hasn't it?
Rocky is one word. I can think of about five or six other words that might be a little more clear on how bad it's been. It's not been good at all. It's not been a friendly situation. There's been plenty of opportunities for the Maroon family to kind of do the right thing by the community, and they've chosen not to for whatever reason. These boarded-up homes on Indian Road is a prime example of that. They have about 125 properties that they own, and they've sat there in some cases 10, 15 years now, just boarded up, rotting away. And they're an eyesore on an entire section of our city. So that's a prime example of how they've done business and how they've chosen to do business. Everybody was saying, why didn't they just let these homes continue to function until they actually had permission for this twin span? So it's not been a good history.
And then tell us, Dave, about the relationship between the Maroons and Ottawa, the Canadian government, through the years.
Well, it depends on the government of the day. And as you know, in your own country, that the governments of the day in the nation's capital can change on a dime. So that's kind of what's happened. We had the Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, who was very gung-ho to get the Gordie Howe Bridge up and started to get things going. He had a team in place. Things were moving very, very quickly. And it looked like this bridge was going to be open and done by 2020. Then we had a change in our Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau. Is now our prime minister, and there's been quite a change. I'm just talking about this bridge project specifically, quite a change in the approach. And it's kind of fallen off the radar quite a bit. Not much has happened since Justin Trudeau's been our prime minister on this project alone.
So should there be concern about the Gordie Howe Bridge, this publicly funded bridge a couple miles downstream near Zug Island?
Yeah, and that's what everybody's going to wait and see. If you're building a brand new six-lane crossing, that the Maroon family is going to operate and get going, what exactly is the need now for the Gordie Howe Bridge? Ottawa said yesterday that they're indeed very committed to it, that they're going to ensure that this Howe Bridge gets built in a timely fashion. They think that there is a need for sure to have two six-lane crossings here at the Windsor-Detroit border.
Are there any other significant hurdles that the Maroons face to get this second bridge next to the Ambassador Bridge?
This was the last remaining major hurdle. There could be still some challenges ahead of them. They need municipal permits. They need some property, I believe, that the Riverside Park on the Detroit side still has to be ironed out in terms of exactly what they need over there. And I'm not sure exactly what state approvals they may need as well, but there may be some permissions that are still required. But I don't really see a whole lot of hurdles in their way from this point on.
So, Dave, bottom line, by 2023 or thereabouts, can we expect to be seeing two bridges between Detroit and Windsor?
I would say 2023 seems to be the current timeline now for the Howe Bridge. I think you'll see the Maroon family move real quick now that they have all their permits in place, and you're going to see a new bridge maybe by 2020, 2021. Their crossing should be up and running, and then what happens with the Howe Bridge and how that plays out still is a story to be told.
Dave Battagello with the Windsor Star has followed the bridge developments for many, many years. Dave, thanks for taking time to talk with us today.
Good to catch up with you, Cynthia. Take care.
Congress gathered behind driverless cars this week. A bipartisan push in the House led to approval of a bill that can help the auto industry as it transforms into something that turns out self-driving vehicles. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here with us. Now, what's in this legislation that the House approved Wednesday, Daniel?
Well, it gives automakers the ability to test up to 100,000 self-driving vehicles on American roads. And this will be done incrementally over a period of years as you reach that number. And the second thing I think is most important is it bars states from passing legislation that would block automakers from making those testing those kinds of vehicles. This is really revolutionary in a lot of ways, and it's even more revolutionary in the sense that it's A, bipartisan in Donald Trump's Washington, and B, it's the government trying to get out front of this drive for self-driving cars. One of the things that Senator Gary Peters said to me on multiple occasions is he was always afraid that the feds were going to be the obstacle because bureaucracies move slowly, because government really doesn't understand some of the technology and some of the technical issues, nor the pace of change. And this, I think, is a very refreshing kind of move that signals that both parties seem to understand this from many parts of the country, not just from the industrial Midwest and not just from California and Silicon Valley, but across the country.
Now, it's interesting, as this progress happens on Capitol Hill, I got an email from a stateside listener who has noted the many conversations we've had lately about driverless cars. I'm going to put this out here. Here's part of what he said. What I never hear is a discussion not of how and when, but why. Why do we want these things? Or more to the point, do we want these things? In a mix of half driverless and half human-driven cars, let's say with a tad of snow falling, does anyone want to experience that? It's Christmas Eve, 6 p.m. You get in your driverless car from last-minute Christmas shopping at Briarwood. There's one parking spot and three driverless cars all aiming for it. Does anyone really want to experience that? He's like, I'll never buy one. He was right out there. And that's a question. What if the car makers are working on something people don't want?
Well, what would that guy say about the iPhone? When he was asked if he wanted the iPhone in 2007, he said, I don't need that. Why would I want that? The reality is that we live in a world where technology continues to advance. And I've had some discussions, and I think I've used this on your air before. You know, if the technology is possible, it's impossible to stop it. To the writers' point, I would say that media and the financial markets are much farther ahead on self-driving cars probably than the reality. I mean, you have companies like Ford Motor Company say, we're going to have a self-driving car in the market by 2021. Well, that's not very far away, right?
No.
But then there are people out in Silicon Valley say, you don't understand. You don't understand how precise the technology needs to be. And the reality is it's not nearly going to be ready by 2021. So it's really going to, I think it's going to be something that unspools over time. But I mean, he's basically saying that these cars are answering a question that a lot of people are not asking.
Hmm. That point, your column today has this survey from Alex Partners saying that 55% of people say they're unlikely to buy one, and 49% say they're not confident enough in the technology to consider buying one.
Exactly. And a vast majority of people, I think the number was 78%, don't trust the automakers to develop the software to keep them safe. So I think auto companies have got a bigger mountain to climb here in terms of convincing and persuading people that they are going to be able to develop the technology. There's a much greater faith in Silicon Valley and the Apples and Googles of the world to develop the technology and the software to keep them safe in a situation. Now, obviously, they're not going to be building the product. I think those companies, have, at least so far, have made it abundantly clear they're not getting in the car business. But how they get into the self-driving car business remains to be seen, meaning somebody is going to be building those products for them. But there are already driverless shuttles, I think, on the North Campus of the University of Michigan. I think they launched just this month.
Yes.
And, you know, that's where you're going to see the applications initially is going to be in kinds of mass transit and things like that. It's going to be before you're going to see it in personal transportation. You know, this is a huge race. This is the biggest change to the automotive industry since the moving assembly line. And the stakes are huge for the traditional automakers, including Detroit's automakers. And there's no guarantee that they're going to come out on top here. There's a lot of skepticism on Wall Street. I'm starting to see it more and more in analyst reports. They just don't believe that these old companies are going to be able to respond quickly enough to the fast pace of change in the self-driving space. I would try to give them a benefit of the doubt a little bit and think, you know, they're moving pretty quickly. And a company like General Motors, for example, is doing some things that they never did before in the past. Now, maybe they're running scared, but I think they're also trying to be smart.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
Coming up, the fascinating story of the Kellogg brothers of Battle Creek and how they changed the way we eat breakfast. Then the U.S., Canada, and Mexico are renegotiating NAFTA, and Canada is putting right-to-work laws on the negotiating table.
This is sort of a bargaining chip where Canada's entire kind of strategy with NAFTA is to try to put a whole bunch of big things on the table themselves, you know, with the idea that they can sort of bargain those down or trade them off.
That's in 20 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Kellogg's, good morning. The best to you each morning. K-E-L-L.
Oh, double good.
Kellogg's best to you.
That chirpy, cheery jingle meant breakfast to countless families over the generations. You open that box of Kellogg's Corn Flakes or maybe Rice Krispies, pour on the milk, and you've got breakfast. But the story behind that catchy jingle and that bowl of cornflakes, it's a bitter family feud. The Seventh-day Adventist religion, a healthy, holy lifestyle, and some sexual abstinence. It's the story of Dr. John Harvey Kellogg and his younger brother, Will Keith Kellogg, both of them from Battle Creek, a story told by U of M medical historian Dr. Howard Markell in his new book, The Kellogg's, The Battling Brothers of Battle Creek. And Howard, battle they did, which we will get to. But what was it that drew you to their story to turn it into this book?
Well, originally I was drawn to Dr. John Harvey Kellogg because I'm a physician and a medical historian. And I knew of him and his work. And in medical school, I used to read his magazine, Good Health, was in the stacks of the old Taubman Library. And so when I was bored or I didn't want to jam this fact or factoid into my head, I would read them. So I knew his papers were all here at the University of Michigan at our Bentley Historical Library. So I was drawn to him initially. And then the more I uncovered his life, the more I met up with his little brother, Will. And the story was so compelling and the conflict was so great. I love conflict. I love writing about conflict. I don't like it in my own life, but I love writing about it. And it just, the story just kept unfolding and unfolding and getting better and better.
So when the Kelloggs moved to Battle Creek in 1856, What was the typical American breakfast like?
Oh, my, Americans ate very badly by today's standards, whether it was breakfast, lunch, or dinner. But breakfast was often fried up, cured meats, bacon, and ham. So there's a great deal of fat and salt. Potatoes were often consumed, and they were fried up in the congealed fat left over from the night before.
So we'll make these potatoes really unhealthy.
Really crispy, but really unhealthy.
Yeah.
There might have been mugs of cocoa and coffee, tea, sometimes boiled rice that was doused with molasses or fat. And it took quite a bit of time to make these meals. The healthiest meal might be a bowl of mush, but these whole grains took hours to boil and cook so that they were soft and palatable. But it was not a healthy diet by any stretch.
And it's certainly, you can tell that John Harvey Kellogg was extremely fixated on stomach and intestinal health from a very, very early age, which carried through into his medical school years.
He was the poor man. First of all, his mom, before they got into a healthier diet, made the same type of food that I just described. His favorite meal was braised oxtails in a greasy, heavy brown gravy, and he loved eating. And he ate a lot of candy, too. And he developed colitis, a bloody colitis with scars on his intestine. He developed terrible constipation and hemorrhoids. And one of the most painful things known to mankind, an anal fissure, which is a tear in that region, which does not heal very quickly because you open it up almost every day. And it hurts like the dickens. It brings new meaning to the expression, you're a pain in the fill in the blank.
A big part of the story, as well as the pretty rotten diet Americans had, is the Seventh-day Adventist Church, centered right in Battle Creek, and that's why the Kelloggs came to Battle Creek, right?
Yeah, so the Kelloggs originally settled in Flint from Connecticut, but they were a religious family, and this was around the time of the Second Great Awakening, and the Seventh-day Adventists were just starting their denomination, and they settled in Battle Creek. That was the Vatican of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, which was founded by James and Ellen White. Ellen White was a self-proclaimed prophetess. She had conversations with God or testimonies with God and would then tell her flock about them. So there was a lot of Christianity. It was the Adventists, so they believed in the coming of Jesus Christ, the second coming, and only a select few, the most pious, would ascend to heaven, something that really disturbed John Harvey Kellogg as a young boy, wondering, will I be holy enough to make that ascent? And there were a great many what Ellen called health reforms, which, you know, Christianity in the mid-19th century in America had a lot of health issues connected to their spiritual and religious issues. No wonder, because their flock was dying like flies. So she had all these health reforms to have a clean body. That was your temple, so to speak. So you were spiritually clean, you were physically clean, you were sexually clean. So the diet that one ate should be a grain and vegetable diet. That's how she interpreted Genesis, for example. No meat of any kind, no alcohol or caffeine, no tobacco, no condiments, because this food was often tasteless, and a lot of spicy condiments were developed, you know, spicy mustards and so on. And so none of those that she felt were either excitatory or produced bad health. And of course, she also prescribed a chaste lifestyle where sex was only for procreation.
So young John Harvey Kellogg grew up in this religion and then got a lot of support, as you point out, from the Whites in his medical studies, because they had their eye on him to be the medical director of their Western Health Reform Institute in Battle Creek. What was that?
You're right. He was their chosen one, obviously brilliant from even as a child or a young man. And they wanted to expand the health reform part of their ministry by having an institute of health reform where people would come and learn about the health reforms, eat a healthy diet, maybe exercise, what have you. The Western Health Reform Institute was basically a house, and there were some quacky doctors who gave boring, droning lectures and some very tasteless food. And those who came rarely came back. And so they were having a real, as we say in the hospital business, a census problem. They couldn't fill the beds.
And then John Harvey Kellogg becomes the director once he gets out of medical school,
right,
which they underwrote for him pretty much,
yes,
right? And comes up with an entirely new word to name the place. And it's a word that we would get, but he invented the word sanitarium?
Yes, he invented the word sanitarium.
And what was that new word supposed to tell the world about this place?
Well, the root of it, sanitas, which is Latin for health, it was really a place of health, or as he liked to call it, a university of health, where people were taught how to live healthier lifestyles. And in a way that was not reform. You see, he knew that nobody likes reform, John Harvey said. No one likes the idea of reform. But the idea of going to a university of health, people might be willing to do that.
Pretty good spin.
It was a very good spin, and he was a great wordsmith, and he was one of his great talents was the ability to write and come up with metaphors and similes that people would understand. And so he changed everything. He changed the diet. He made it much more palatable. He changed the activities so they were fun. He developed all sorts of exercise machines that would get the pounds off. There were sing-alongs and entertainment. And, of course, the greatest feature of the Battle Creek Sanitarium, as he named it, was John Harvey Kellogg. He was just a brilliant showman.
So he was kind of a rock star, if you will, in the health movement. And when the place burned down, as you describe in The Battling Brothers of Battle Creek, he pulled out the stops and really rebuilt it and offered so many more services at the San, and as he called it, and I had to laugh that the Sanctum Sanctorum was basically what, the colonic room, the enema room.
Yeah, that was his special place.
Yeah.
So the San burnt out, the wooden structure burned down in 1902. He built a glorious and much better one, a grand hotel, basically, that famous people from around the world came to.
Like?
Booker T. Washington, Sojourner Truth, Amelia Earhart, Johnny Weissmuller, Eddie Cantor, William Howard Taft, Warren Harding, John Philip Sousa. I could go on and
Battle
on.
Battle Creek was really bustling.
Yeah,
I'm
it
sure.
was the number two stop on the Michigan Central line, with Detroit being number one.
Although I note, as you note in your book, cynics called the patients battle freaks. So
battle
not
freaks.
Everybody was on board with this.
Yeah. And they called themselves that.
Now, we have to bring Will Keith Kellogg into this. Is it fair to say he was the flunky, the whipping boy around the San?
Well, for a lot of his life, Will was pronounced poor Will, because that's how everyone referred to him. He was more than just a flunky or a lackey to Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, even though he felt that way and wrote about it in his own diary. He was younger by 8 years. John never missed an opportunity to humiliate or physically harm or psychologically harm his little brother.
Going back to when they were little
Going
boys.
Back to they were little
yes.
kids.
Wow.
In fact, Will's memory of his brother as a child, this is an old man, but he's remembering it. On cold winter nights, John Harvey would put his feet on Will's back to warm them. That's his memory. And John would taunt Will and treat him badly. Now, Will was considered dim-witted, as they said. He didn't do well in school, and he barely finished what we call high school. And it turned out he needed glasses, and he didn't know he was nearsighted till he was 20 years old. That's one reason why the Will Kellogg Foundation is very interested in eye issues, and the University of Michigan has the Kellogg Eye Institute.
All right.
The other thing that he was concerned about were dental issues, because he lost most of his teeth when he was still a teenager, and we have the Will Kellogg Foundation Dental Institute at the University of Michigan.
There we go. Yeah. And he did work at the San, and then it turned out he was a genius in business and everything John wasn't.
Right. So, you know, you need always an outside guy and an inside guy in every business partnership. So John was the outside guy, drumming up the business, bringing in the people. But Will was more than a lackey. He was a brilliant administrator. And this was a huge place. It had thousands of employees. It had, you know, farms and kitchen and laundry and maids and nurses and doctors. And Will had to run all the, what we call today, human resources. He had to run all the billing, all the accounting, all the vendors. He dealt with so many people, and he did it all in his head. And he was just incredible at doing so. And of course, John could not only treat him badly, but he could trust him because he was his brother. But he never got the credit for doing that. He never got an accolade. He never had a formal title. And this is why Will felt at the age of 46, I'm a flunky. I'll never be more than John Harvey's flunky, is what he wrote.
I'm talking with Dr. Howard Markell, U of M medical historian. His latest book, The Kelloggs, The Battling Brothers of Battle Creek. And now it's time to ask about the cornflakes. Let's talk cornflakes. What led to the birth of the cornflake?
Okay. First, a disclosure, I love cornflakes, but I love sugar-frosted cornflakes even more. The idea was to create a food that was highly digestible. Now, John Harvey was obsessed not only with how the colon worked or the GI tract worked, but he wanted to develop foods that were easy to digest and would not cause an upset stomach. And so he had a theory about grains that if you bake them for a long period of time at a high temperature, you would break that starch molecule into a simple sugar, dextrose, which is true. That does happen. And when you eat that, it would be easily digested as soon as you start chewing it and mixing it with your saliva. Now, the first thing he made was a Zweiback biscuit, a hard double-baked biscuit. And as the story goes, a woman broke her dentures while biting into this biscuit, and she wanted 10 bucks for new dentures, which was a considerable amount of money back then.
This was
the 1880s. And John Harvey didn't want to do that. So then he started breaking down the biscuits into crumbs. That was okay. It was his first cereal. It was called granola.
Interesting.
There was another guy named James Jackson in New York who was making his own cereal called granola, similar. His was wheat crumbs. John Harvey said, well, ours are wheat with a little bit of corn and some barley crumbs. The lawyers prevailed upon him, and he changed the name to Granos, which was still the wheat crumbs, and people liked that, but it wasn't a big hit. There was another guy named Henry Perkey who made something we now know as shredded wheat, and he figured out how to spool out the wheat, boiled wheat, into these tiny threads and then wrap it up into the biscuits we know as shredded wheat. And John Harvey tried to buy the patent for that, and it didn't go well. He was always bad at business. He had a deal, and then he wanted a better deal, and Perkey said, you know, forget it. And he made a mint on his shredded wheat. But John Harvey was, you know, always optimistic. He came back to Battle Creek, and he told his brother, we'll create something better. And so they worked with, you know, various batches of dough, and they did various things to it. They spun it, they rolled it, they flattened it, and finally his wife gave an advice, let's flatten it even more, let's make it like paper thin. And they baked it a certain way, and they actually had a mistake. And the mistake was John Harvey was called to see a patient, that's the way he tells the story, and he couldn't finish that batch of dough. Will said they were just tired and they wanted to go to bed that night. But Will was very frugal and he put the dough up for another day. He didn't want to throw out that batch. Well, what happened is that dough became tempered. And bakers know about this. Basically, the water content evens out throughout the batch of dough. It's not just in little pockets. And it also becomes slightly moldy. It's not moldy enough to alter the taste, but it's slightly moldy. And so when they rolled out that batch, it came out in perfect flakes when they carved it up and they had it.
As we go through your book, you know, you would think that this would be John Harvey Kellogg's triumph, but ultimately there was a huge legal battle. And how did it wind up that Will Keith got the rights to the family name? And it was, when we think of the company producing the cereals, and boy, it is something, $14 billion a year.
It's a huge international corporation to this day.
How did that wind up in Will Keith's domain?
Well, Will was, you know, working with him. Even though John Harvey took the original patent in the 1890s on flaked cereals, Will was right there and was more than just an assistant. He was coming up with new things all the time. And part of Will's genius was not only his administrative ability, his palate was perfect. He really knew what tasted good. And so the original flakes were made out of wheat, which didn't taste all that well. And then he used corn because it was cheaper and sweeter. And you had to do all sorts of machinations to make corn flakes. And Will worked that out. And then Will left his brother's employ in 1906. I'm going to start my own company. It was called the Battle Creek Toasted Corn Flake Company. We now know it as Kellogg's. And he bought the rights for the corn flakes and the patent. And John Harvey got a ton of corn flake dividends, which made him later on a very wealthy man. And Will added a little bit of salt and a little bit of sugar, and that made corn flakes taste like corn flakes. And that just became the hit of the century. It was started in 1906, but everyone loved it. Will advertised to a fare thee well in all sorts of creative ways. He surrounded himself with brilliant advertising men. They knew how to sell the grocers and the food jobbers and so on. And everywhere you turned was an ad for Kellogg's Corn Flakes. And of course, American mothers loved it because now you could just pour cereal out of a box.
You weren't up at 4 a.m. lighting
right.
fire to
right.
make
and
the mush.
And even Dad could make cereal.
Yeah.
And a lot of other things coalesced at that time to make Kellogg so popular. You had train travel, you had national branding, and you had clean, pasteurized milk on a national basis. So you got to have milk to have a bowl of cornflakes, right? So cornflakes just became the hit of the century. Now, the doctor didn't like that. He didn't like the fact that his brother was successful. And so the doctor came out with his own line of cereals, also called Kellogg's, and they didn't taste as good. And that bothered Will, who had a fiduciary responsibility to his company to battle off people like that. And Will was very good at fending off competitors. He was quite the businessman. And so it turned out to be a giant lawsuit. It started in 1910, it went all the way to 1920. Will sued John Harvey, John Harvey sued Will, and on and on and on. And it went all the way to the Michigan State Supreme Court. And the question was precisely what you ask: who had the rights to the name Kellogg? Who was the real Kellogg that could advertise their wares? And gosh darn it, Will won, because the judge said, look at all these ads, millions and millions of dollars of ads. Millions of Americans read these ads or hear about it on the radio, et cetera. And when you hear the name Kellogg, you think Kellogg's cornflakes.
They never spoke again, did they?
Well, they spoke occasionally, but rarely.
Not well.
And they had terrible fights. Their last meeting a few months before John Harvey died, John wanted some money to save the ailing sanitarium, which really went under during the Depression. Will wanted to close it down because, as he dealt with his business enemies, he did not want John Harvey to have a physical legacy. It turned into an ugly, ugly fight, and then they never spoke again.
Dr. Howard Markell, University of Michigan medical historian. The book is The Kellogg's, The Battling Brothers of Battle Creek. And there is indeed remarkable history in that cereal bowl as you look at your Kellogg's cornflakes. Dr. Markell has a host of appearances around Michigan this fall. You can go to his website, howardmarkell.com, and get all the details. Thank you so much, Howard.
Thanks so much, Cindy.
Still to come, a workspace in Detroit opens with a focus on helping women entrepreneurs. Stay with us. This is Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Vision.
The best and the brightest.
The next idea. When we really see each other, we want to help each other.
Even in 2017, women still face difficulties in the world of business. Studies confirm women are still perceived as less competent than men, less likely to be considered good risks for startup capital, and yes, there's still that pesky wage gap between the sexes. A Detroit businesswoman is fighting back against those characterizations. Megan Ward runs her own business, and she's recently started another venture. It's an all-women co-working space called Femology, a place where women can conduct business and network with one another and take advantage of workshops and events designed with their needs in mind. Megan Ward is with us now via Skype. Welcome to The Next Idea, Megan.
Thanks so much. I am super pumped to be on.
What is Femology?
Femology is the philosophy of women living, working, and thriving in a collaborative society. I definitely feel like right now we're kind of on the tipping point of women understanding their worth, their value, and we need that extra push. So that is what Femology is defined as.
And that's the name you've given to this space now that you've opened up in downtown Detroit?
Yeah. We didn't want something that was pre-existing. We didn't want people to be able to go in the dictionary and say, hey, what does this mean? We wanted to cultivate something new, innovative, and fresh for women in business.
Describe what it is. If I walk through the doors at Femology in Detroit, what will I find?
So if you walk through the doors in Femology, you are going to find a homey slash office feel, but it's all inspired by what a woman is experiencing in business. So, you know, women, we go through different things in business. You know, we're not black and white. That's not how we do business. We're very dynamic in a sense. We're nurturing. We can be business savvy. You know, we're loving. We like to talk. We like to connect. We love people. And so we really wanted women to have like a safe space where they can just exude womanly vibes. At Femology, you might meet another woman who you can do business with, or you can collaborate or partner with, or you might meet another woman who can be your potential mentor, or you can be their mentor. It's really just a safe space for women to thrive, collaborate, and we're based around community.
And how do people belong? Is this based on a membership fee? Because I'm sure you need money to operate this.
Yeah, definitely. So going into this business, I can definitely say my partner and I, she was actually a client of mine. I have a graphic design business, help women do branding. And we were like, hey, you know what? Like, why are we meeting at Starbucks right now? You know, why are we meeting at Panera? And so what we wanted to do, we wanted to create this space together. And honestly, our relationship kind of serves as the foundation for Femology, but we're based around community. So with community, all of our members are on a membership basis. We have 6 and 12 month membership packages. But if you want to just kind of come out and, you know, check us out, give us like a trial, you can definitely do a day pass. So a day pass is, it's kind of like a 1 day thing where you can just drop in, experience Femology, get access to the space, meet some of the other women in there. But yeah, we're totally based around community.
The Google Male Manifesto and some other recent high-profile studies and harassment cases kind of illustrate ways that women are frequently treated differently and worse than men in the business world. Is that something that you or your partner or members that come to Femology can say, yep, that's happened to me?
You know what? That is a topic that is talked about so much in Femology. A core part of our, I want to say about at least 75% of our members have 9-to-5s, but also are building a business on the side. And a core part in why they're building a business is because they're facing pay discrimination or sexism in the workplace, or, you know, not feeling valued or like they have a seat at the table. So yeah, definitely. I know what pushed me into entrepreneurship and having my own business is not getting a $3 raise when I felt like, you know, I deserved it. I felt like it was due time. And so I was kind of like, you know, if I can't get this raise and in this job that I like, then I'm going to create a business that I love.
Would you like to see a day, Megan, where a place like Femology is obsolete, where you basically are able to kind of put it out of business because there is no more difference between the sexes?
You know what? I can honestly say, like, no, I think there's a need. I think there's a need no matter where you go. If we think about it, men's clubs have been present or operating since, you know, as long as we can remember. And so being that, you know, women workspaces and co-working spaces are so new, we face different things. And I think we'll always face different things in business. I honestly want to see, I want to see it grow. I want to see more Michigan. I want to see more across the U.S. You know, they're popping up, but I think we have more work to do.
How do you see Femology contributing to the entrepreneurial ecosystem in our state? I know that's kind of a lofty, jargony term, but you know what I'm saying?
You know what? I definitely think that Femology, it not only serves as a space where women can go and call home, but it's really like a culture. It's really a culture of women in business. A lot of our members, they're very savvy. They're very sweet women, but they also have goals, and they want to check off their goals. So they're very determined. So with this culture centered around Femology, even if you aren't a member at Femology, I think women can get inspired by the Femology brand and just what we stand for and push that into whatever they're doing, whether they have a career and they're trying to rise the corporate ladder or, you know, they're building this business and they want to grow 6 figures or $1 million. I think that Femology serves as that inspiration.
Megan Ward is the co-creator of an all-woman co-working space in downtown Detroit called Femology. Megan, thank you so much for sharing your work with us on The Next Idea.
Thank you so much for having me. Awesome.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
From his earliest days as a candidate, Donald Trump complained bitterly about NAFTA, calling it the worst deal ever. But soon after taking office, he backed away from his pledge to tear up the trade agreement. Instead, the U.S., Canada, and Mexico are now renegotiating NAFTA. Earlier this week, Canada made a demand that could certainly resonate here in Michigan. Canada says, all right, United States, you want to change NAFTA? Then get rid of those right-to-work laws. Yes, the right-to-work laws currently on the books in Michigan and 27 other states. The laws that allow workers to opt out of paying dues to the unions that represent them in collective bargaining. Critics say right-to-work weakens unions by starving them of money. Adrian Morrow covers U.S. politics for Toronto's Globe and Mail. He's based in Washington. Adrian, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Cynthia.
So this demand came during this second round of renegotiation talks in Mexico City. Who is pushing for this and why?
So it's Canada basically wants the U.S. to get rid of its right to work laws, and the reason is the sort of ostensible reason is that Canada basically said, well, hey, Donald Trump, you've kind of put this this question of Mexico taking jobs in the United States by having lower wages and worse union conditions in Mexico than the U.S. does. So it's only fair to put the U.S.'s labor laws on the table as well and say, hey, the U.S. is taking jobs away from potentially Canadian workers by having right to work laws, which don't exist in Canada. And so Canada is basically saying that they want the U.S. ostensibly to pass some sort of federal legislation that would bar states from enacting right to work legislation. So that's sort of the theoretical kind of ostensible reason. The real reason more is that this is sort of a bargaining chip where Canada's entire kind of strategy with NAFTA is to try to put a whole bunch of big things on the table themselves, with the idea that they can sort of bargain those down or trade them off, to sort of stop things that Donald Trump might want to do that would take away, market access or sort of take away pieces of NAFTA that Canada likes.
Yeah, and as you say, Canada's pushing Mexico on its low wages as well. So it's mm-hmm. pushing on the two fronts.
Yeah, that's correct. Canada's basically said, that they want both Mexico to either raise wages or at the very least to sort of change their union culture there. Because right now, most, Mexican unionized workers in Mexico generally belong to sort of corporate controlled unions. So Canada wants that changed. They also want the U.S. to get rid of right to work laws. And they want both the U.S. and Mexico to bring in paid parental leave sort of at the same level as Canada, which is 1 year of paid parental leave. So those are sort of the labor changes Canada's asking for.
Have the policy changes in the United States that have led to right-to-work laws, have they had any demonstrable impact in Canada, or is this more of a perception and a concern?
It's probably more of a perception to concern at this point. Part of the problem is more sort of in the attracting new investment, the area of attracting new investment, because there have been quite a few car plants built in the last number of years, and certainly in Ontario, which has some of the highest wages and sort of most sort of labor-friendly labor laws on the continent. I think there is definitely a sense within the Ontario government that it's much harder for them to compete with jurisdictions in the U.S. And with Mexico, just because of that, because the wages are high, because the union culture is quite strong, and so often the government in Ontario will offer incentives or will sort of give money to car companies to make investments or to set up shop in Ontario as sort of a way to try to sort of sweeten the pot when you've got all these states in the U.S. that have lower wages than Ontarians do. So there's certainly a perception out there. I'm not sure the extent to which it's actually been quantified, but I think a lot of it has to do with kind of attracting new jobs and sort of new car plants that there's a sense in Canada that we're at a disadvantage in getting, getting these kinds of these new plants set up because the wages are higher.
Adrian, I'm wondering how this demand is playing in Canada. And to that point, I'm looking right now at an opinion piece by the CBC's Neil MacDonald calling these demands virtue signaling. And he's arguing Canada has no business lecturing Mexico and the U.S. over labor laws because millions of Canadian jobs depend on it. And he says Prime Minister Trudeau doesn't really have a plan B if President Trump rips up NAFTA.
Yeah, I think virtue signaling is certainly a way to put it. I mean, a lot of what Canada is putting on the table has more to do with, A, negotiating, and B, sort of playing to domestic constituencies than it does sort of things that they seriously think they're going to get. Because, the Trudeau government obviously is, opposed to right to work, is in favor of fighting climate change, is in favor of incorporating sort of gender, gender parity provisions into NAFTA and sort of basically putting these kind of social policy pieces into the trade agreement. The Trudeau government certainly wants all that, and they're sincere about it, but I think they're realists. I mean, they know that that's never actually going to happen. I think they know that Donald Trump is not going to agree to put climate change, or sort of anti-right to work, provisions into the deal. But I think they feel, A, they want to put it on the table because it's something they can then negotiate down from, but also B, it sort of helps them domestically with, the sort of people who vote for the Liberal Party of Canada or the sort of people who probably are in favor of labor-friendly labor laws and probably are in favor of fighting climate change. So, I think there is sort of a domestic politics piece and a stakeholder management piece as well, right? Where, the Liberals want, Canada's largest union, represents auto workers along with a bunch of other people. And so I think that the Liberals sort of, would like to have them on side or sort of like to have their validation for whatever happens with NAFTA. And so sort of putting their issues on the table is a way to do that.
The third round of talks is happening September 23rd through the 27th in Ottawa. What should we look for, do you think?
I mean, the main thing that I think we're hopefully going to see then is that the U.S. might put some meat on the bones of one of their most contentious demands, which is this idea that there might be they might want a U.S. content requirement in cars and trucks. And other sort of manufactured goods. So I think that'll probably be the biggest thing that both Canada and Mexico are waiting for, because they've both said publicly, you know, Canada and Mexico, that, you know, no way, no how, they would never allow some sort of, U.S. content requirement on manufactured goods. But the U.S., despite having sort of signaled this publicly that they're going to do this, they haven't actually put any numbers on the table or sort of put the formal proposal on the table that Canada and Mexico can react to. So I think that's potentially the largest thing that we might see in Ottawa. They might sort of finally put that out. The other thing that I understand they haven't quite broached yet is this possible sort of these Buy American carve-outs in public procurement, which again is something that both Canada and Mexico are not big fans of. So if they sort of put forward proposals on either of those in Ottawa, I think then that those could be sort of the biggest flashpoints. Other than that, it's mostly going to be in Ottawa. I think they're going to try to take a lot of the smaller stuff where there is agreement and sort of get that off the table, get it out of the way, so they can then sort of focus on the big sticking points.
Adrian Morrow covers U.S. politics for Toronto's Globe and Mail. Adrian, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
Time for Am I Curious, where you ask the question and we dig up the answer for you. Here's today's question.
Hi, my name is Blake Trombley from Canton, Michigan, and I'm curious, why are so many of Michigan's vineyards located on the coast?
Blake told us he specifically wants to know how cooling effects from the Great Lakes impact our state's wineries. With us now to answer Blake's question is Brad Boffman, who's a horticulture educator at Michigan State University, also an adjunct professor at Southwestern Michigan College. Great to have you with us, Brad.
Great to be with you.
Why do we see most vineyards on coastal regions?
So it's interesting that your listener's question was phrased as, what is the cooling effect? It's more a warming effect from the water than a cooling effect that helps us, which might seem a little counterintuitive at first.
Yeah, because usually I think we think of cooler temperatures, you know, at the coastline.
Yeah, we do in the summertime.
Mm.
But in the wintertime, the water is warmer than the land, which means that as the wind is coming out of the west over Lake Michigan, it's actually warmer when it comes off Lake Michigan versus if it was coming off the land. So for grapevines, what that means is, if we can sort of put ourselves in January or February and say it's the coldest night in the middle of the winter, it's 0 degrees.
All right.
Or -5 or -10, or during those polar vortex years, even colder, right? So on a night like that, if we're close to the water, especially within 10 miles of the water, but even 20 miles, it's going to be warmer than if we were inland.
Interesting.
Yeah.
When I think of all the vineyards I've seen on the Leelanau Peninsula, that's why.
That is one of the reasons they are there. Grapevines are a little wimpy when it comes to dealing with cold temperatures, which obviously is a part of life for us in Michigan. But those cold temperatures are actually moderated by the warming influence of the lake in the wintertime.
So when we think about what we have here in Michigan, how does what our condition along the lake coast of Michigan, how does that impact the kind of grapes we can grow here?
So we're limited in Michigan in several ways. Number one, what is the minimum temperature we're going to get to in the middle of the winter? And as I was talking about earlier, closer to the water, that's going to be a little warmer. Mm-hmm. But it's still a lot colder than a lot of the wine grape growing regions in the world, right?
Right.
So we have a number of grapes that we've sort of tried to grow in Michigan and are really hard to do here unless you, like, pull the vines off of the trellis and bury them under straw in the wintertime to protect them from the cold. Mm. There's a lot of varieties that we have a very hard time with here. But then there are other varieties that actually do really well in our shorter growing season and actually make for much better wine because of the cool temperatures that we can get here. In the fall. Some of those would be Riesling, Cabernet Franc, Lemberger, Chardonnay. It's funny because people don't think of Michigan as a wine state, well, a little bit more now than they used to.
Yes.
But there are certain varieties that here we can get beautiful acid development that in other regions of the world they really struggle to get, and we have no problem with it here.
And thus we have some of these award-winning Michigan wines.
Indeed.
Brad Boffman is a Michigan State University horticulture educator. We want to thank you so much for helping us with Am I Curious?
I'm so glad I could be on, and I would encourage your listeners to drink Michigan wine, because that's my bread and butter. So
there we go. Thank you so much, Brad. And we also thank our Am I Curious question asker, Blake Trombley, for asking the question, why are so many of Michigan's vineyards located on the coasts? If you have a question about Michigan that you'd like us to dig into, just go to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.